So good afternoon. My name is Yehuda Kupfer. Professionally, some may know me as Judah Kupfer. Welcome to Agudath Israel of America's Legal and Compliance webinar titled The Law of the Land, the Harry H. Baron Dean B'Machlus Adina series. Today's session is Pointers and Pitfalls for Nonprofit Leaders, Money Laundering, Tax Evasion, and Other Criminal Laws. It's a mouthful, and it's going to be a lot of information that's going to be presented today. We're very, very pleased to have with us Brian Skarlatos, who's a partner at Costanza & Fink. We only have an hour. I'm not going to go through his bio, which would probably take an hour to read, but everyone can Google his name and go to his bio on his firm's website, and you'll see literally decades of experience. He's often quoted in the Wall Street Journal. He's a very frequent speaker at many occasions, and I mean, we're very pleased to have a true expert in this field, and it is an important field. Several years ago, about 2009, 2010 timeframe, we did a series of seminars that many of the folks who are joining may have participated in. We're glad to be able to continue to provide substantive information about important topics. This time in the webinar series, and again, we're very glad to be able to continue to do this so long as there's a desire and an interest in learning about these important topics. A couple of things that I've been asked to announce. There's going to be another webinar on the Parsonage QTR plans and other similar topics that's scheduled for Wednesday, June 28th at 3 p.m. from Ari Hutman that's going to be presenting. A couple of technical issues and instructions. We're going to have a question and answer opportunity subsequent to the presentation. So Brian's going to go for about 40, 45 minutes, and then there's going to be an opportunity for some discussion for some questions. On your screens, perhaps on the right, there is a chat button which allows you to submit your questions or comments to the panelists. There is up a PowerPoint presentation during the session, and you're able to control viewing that as well as viewing the speaker as well. So without further delay, let's get started. Brian, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Judah, and I really appreciate that nice introduction. Maybe you can call my wife later and tell her what a great guy. And Shai, thanks for having me over. And then thanks to you folks for coming and everybody from tuning in out there in TV land or whatever it is, spending your afternoon learning about pointers and, more interestingly, pitfalls for nonprofit leaders. We're going to talk about some pretty interesting stuff. And it's things that come up in my daily practice. So I thought we'd just start off with some real life situations so that you could see what we're talking about here. I just make this thing work. There we go. I got it. I had to click the right button, that's all. So to put things in context, right, I thought we'd go over a couple of common situations that people have asked me. Judah's heard of situations like this, but I've had versions of this in my practice quite a bit. You know, people come to you and say, I'd like to make a donation and get a receipt for the full amount, but I want a certain amount back in cash. That's something that we've seen with some frequency in my office. Also, I'd like to donate something, these rare coins, this piece of art, whatever, but I need an acknowledgement showing that it's worth $50,000 when, you know, it's really worth $10,000 or something like that. I had an interesting criminal case on that one time where somebody donated a piece of real estate in upstate Albany to a church out in Long Island, and they had purchased the real estate for a dollar, subdivided it, put a shopping center on one piece to get it on the tax rolls and all that sort of thing. It was very productive thing. And then the other piece, which they essentially paid 50 cents for, donated to the church, took a $500,000 donation, and then a few weeks later, the church turned around and sold it for $50,000. And so that actually became a criminal case, and the church was involved. Then how about the other thing where one of your colleagues comes to you and says, I'm being audited, and I need you to give me a receipt claiming I made a donation, even though they never made that donation. Or maybe even a little bit more realistically, I'm going to make you a donation now for $10,000, but I need you to give me a receipt for 2015, because that's the year I'm getting audited, okay? A big donor to your institution comes to you and says, you know, I've been donating all along, but now I need a loan back from the funds to make an elaborate wedding for my child. You know, I may pay it back, may not, we'll see how it goes, but, you know, I've given you so much, so that shouldn't be a problem. Or how about that? Now we're getting into the cash, right? And whenever there's cash, we'll talk about it a little bit more. You have to be careful because it's not actually illegal to transact in cash. You can do things in cash. It's just that it all has to be reported properly and treated properly. Because the Treasury and the Department of Justice considers cash to be sort of like smoke. Where there's smoke, there's fire. They figure where there's cash, there's illegal activity. So the smoke or the cash itself isn't illegal, but they use that as a signal. Okay, so cash is like a smoke signal. So whenever you see cash, you should be wary. There could be a fire or illegal activity somewhere. So somebody comes to you with a bag of cash and says, I want to make a loan, and I don't need a receipt or anything, but when I want it back, I'm going to come back and ask you to write me a check. That should raise a lot of alarms if somebody would engage in a transaction like that. Or how about, I'd like you to take this double endorsed check for me as a donation, okay? It's not really coming directly from me, but it's double endorsed. I'm going to give it to you, and now I'm endorsing it over to the institution. I may need a loan back from you later. Listen, you got to watch when there's anything funny like that, because those are signs that maybe somebody's hiding something or covering something up that you need to know about so you don't get pulled into their improper conduct. Or it could just be as easy as cashing a check. I know you get a lot of cash donations on a given weekend, and I can help you out with that. I'll give you a check. You give me the cash. It's all okay. You know, another version of it is you could become a check casher there, right? And the money transmitting business, money service businesses, you have to register. There are all kinds of compliance obligations. Something I see in my office quite a bit is I'll give you cash here, and then I just need money to show up in another country, Switzerland, Israel, wherever it is. Or I'm over in Switzerland, Israel, I give you cash there, and the money needs to show up here. That's an illegal money transmitting business. That needs to be registered, and there are all kinds of crimes that can flow from engaging in that conduct, too. So this is just some common situations that arise all the time. I'm sure some of you out there have seen these. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to, fall back into some legal stuff. I know Judah asked me to come here because Judah took a class that I gave at NYU Law School. And covered some of this stuff. So now we're going to do some legal stuff. We're going to get a jam into the next 30 minutes, what normally is, about 6 or 7 hours at NYU. But I'll do it in a way, hopefully keep it interesting. So the first thing we want to talk about is money laundering. What is it? People have a lot of misconceptions about money laundering. They think it's any time you're like hiding the source of money. Because that's like laundering it, right? It comes in and now you're going to put it in your charity and you're going to pay it back out. It's going to look like it's coming from the charity. That in itself isn't per se illegal, okay? But it should, just like when you're dealing with cash, give rise to concerns, because anytime the source of something is being hidden, again, that or changed or covered up in any way, that in itself isn't illegal, but it should be what's called a badge of fraud that heightens the level of investigation, the level at which you're looking at something, the sensitivity around the situation, if you will. Technically, what money laundering itself is up there on the screen, it's 18 U.S.C. 1957. Basically, money laundering is when a person engages in a monetary transaction, and under 1957, it has to be more than $10,000, with the proceeds of a specified unlawful activity, if the person knows the money is from some form of unlawful activity. So, to break it down, you engage in some type of a financial transaction, basically a monetary transaction. And a monetary transaction is very broad. It does not have to be cash. It's not cash. It just means a financial transaction. A financial transaction means any transaction with a financial institution. So now we're talking about checks with financial institution, putting money in a bank with a check, withdrawing money, writing a check that gets cashed to the bank. So you're causing a financial transaction to occur. And actually the courts have interpreted this so broadly is that they say it involves any transaction that affects interstate commerce. So that also included somebody who had cash and drove on an interstate highway. You drove on an interstate highway, you affected interstate commerce, and you had cash in your car. That became a monetary transaction. So any type of a very broadly defined monetary transaction, even checks into or checks out of a bank, is what we're looking for. And then if you've got a monetary transaction, the question is twofold. One, did you know that it involved some form of illegal activity? Was some illegal activity involved? Okay. And then was it in fact the proceeds of a specified unlawful activity? Now, this is kind of confusing, but you had to think it was somehow dirty. You don't have to know how it's dirty. You just have to think that it's illegal. But then it, in fact, has to be the proceeds of specific crimes, like money, like wire fraud, mail fraud, bankruptcy fraud, but interestingly, not tax fraud, not tax fraud. So just because money is involved in tax evasion and you do transactions with money that was saved through tax evasion, that does not become money laundering, okay? But almost every other crime is involved, is covered. So if it could be anything else, and by the way, prosecutors are very creative. If they want to get somebody for money laundering and it's a tax crime, you know what they say? That the tax return that you sent in through the mail was false. And so you submitted a false document in the mail. So not only is that tax evasion, that's also what? Mail fraud. That's mail fraud. Yeah. You're affecting interstate commerce via the mails and it's a fraudulent document. So it's mail fraud. And that is a specified unlawful activity. So now we can get you for money laundering. So, you know, an aggressive prosecutor who wants to get you can get you, even if it's a tax crime. But tax crimes are accepted for money laundering. So again, money laundering is when you engage in a transaction with dirty money, essentially. Okay, that's what you're looking at. It's a 10-year felony plus forfeiture of really all the money that you engaged in. But get this, it can also involve forfeiture of the bank accounts through which you put the money, because they said, even if it was, you know, $20,000 that went into the bank account from the illegal activity and the bank account had $2 million in it, they said that you used that $2 million to try to hide the 20. And so the bank account itself facilitated the money laundering. They take the whole $2 million, okay, for a $20,000 transaction. So, but you're not really worried about that when you're facing a 10-year felony, okay? So, and then you say, and again, that on the screen, just depositing the proceeds of an illegal activity into the bank, if you know that it's dirty, can be this money laundering crime. And then you say, well, it's $10,000. What if I only do $5,000? There's a separate crime, 1956, 18 U.S. 1956, that has a few more requirements. So it's a little bit harder for prosecutors to prove, but it can catch even smaller amounts. So money laundering is very broad, basically engaging in financial transactions with dirty money. Bam, money laundering. All right. Let's talk about currency transaction reporting requirements for just a minute. So this is the stuff you hear about where you can't take out more than $10,000 of cash or put more than $10,000 of cash into the bank. So that's what everybody thinks, but that's actually not the law. The way I just said it, you can take out more than $10,000 and you can put in more than $10,000. You just have to report it. You just file the currency transaction report. But then, you know, of course, there's a record at the government that they know you did this. It's not really a big deal though. It goes to a place called FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and it goes on there and it goes on record. And then if you otherwise get audited or investigated, they ping FinCEN and see that you had all these transactions. So it's an investigation tool to see all of these currency transaction reports going in. It's not really something that's going to trigger prosecutions or investigations in and of itself. But if you otherwise get triggered for an investigation or a prosecution or a civil audit, then they're going to look at FinCEN and see that you were having all these transactions. So that's really what it's about. There is a corollary to this, which is called the suspicious activity report. The suspicious activity report is filed by the bank, and that's for any transaction that they think is suspicious. By law, it's really only transactions of more than $3,000, but I'm telling you what banks do is they have very sophisticated computer programs that these big accounting firms sell them, and the computer programs will kick out any transaction that looks suspicious. And they set the tolerance for that is very low, meaning anything that could conceivably be suspicious, even if it's less than $3,000, will get kicked out. And then a bank compliance officer will review it and decide whether they should file a suspicious activity report with FinCEN. Now, suspicious activity reports do get reviewed by the IRS and sometimes by people at the Department of Justice. Those can trigger an audit. Unlike a currency transaction report, not as likely, a suspicious activity report, much more likely. Here's the key about a suspicious activity report. You don't know it's been filed, okay? The bank is not allowed to tell you that they've done it. And when do they file a suspicious activity report? As soon as there's either one unusual transaction, but more likely, if there's a pattern of unusual transactions that occur, and it can be far less than $10,000, okay? If you're engaging in cash transactions of $4,000 or $5,000 or $3,000 over and over and over, it'll kick out an SAR. In fact, I have a client who had an elderly relative, and as a part of you know, some planning they were doing, they were taking out $3,000 out of her account every week or every other day, really, for years, and we're talking it got to be hundreds of thousands of dollars. The bank filed suspicious activity reports. The government got involved. Then the government got Human Protective Services involved, and they actually came and appointed a guardian for the elderly aunt, and a whole big court case about it. The IRS is looking at it. So all from suspicious activity reports involving small amounts of cash, three theft out of an ATM. But the fact that it was over and over and over again triggered these suspicious activity reports. So currency transaction reports, more than $10,000 of legal tender, not checks, but it can be any euros work, any denomination from any country, legal tender works to trigger a CTR. Then the next one down there is the report of currency received in a trade or business. It's called a CMIR. It's a form 8300 also. And there, if you receive more than $10,000 of cash in a trade or business, and again, we're talking about legal tender, not bearer instruments, not collectibles, we're talking about money. In a trade or business, then the person who receives it is required to file this form 8300. It's sort of like a form 1099, but you file it with the government. You say, hey, Judah paid me $11,000 cash. What that's supposed to do is then trigger a question to Judah, where did you get the $11,000 of cash? Okay, it doesn't automatically work that way because they haven't, you know, got their computer systems working that well. But if you do get audited otherwise or investigated, they'll see that you were buying stuff with cash, and then they're going to want to know how did you get the cash. So people get in trouble with this though when they don't file the 8300. So a lot of times it's the person receiving the $11,000 of cash who gets in trouble if they don't file the form 8300. Now, for nonprofits, how does it affect you? A nonprofit is not a trade or business, okay? So it doesn't affect the nonprofit unless it's in connection with a related trade or business. You all know about unrelated taxable business taxable income, UBT. So, unrelated business taxable income. So if you've got that and you're engaging in some sort of separate activity and somebody gives you cash in connection with that activity, then that could trigger the Form 8300, okay? Let's go on. So this is the currency or monetary instrument report. This is the CMIR. This is when you're at JFK and you're leaving the country, you're coming in, and those are those signs all over the place, say you gotta file this form if you're taking more than $10,000 in or out of the country. This is so the IRS can monitor the flow of money in and out of the country, of course, cash. Now this applies to more than just cash. It also applies, you can see up there, traveler's checks, bearer instruments, including, interestingly, checks made out to cash or even a signed check that's not filled in becomes a monetary instrument that has to be reported on a CMIR because it's like cash, okay? Judah gives me a check that's been signed by him. I can take it, fly to another country and hand it to somebody. That's like cash. They can go to a bank and get the money out of that. So that's another report that you have to, so the government's watching money coming in and out of the country. And then the final sort of currency transaction reporting requirement is $10,000 or more in a financial institution in a foreign country, a foreign financial institution. I think we've all heard about the FBARs now and what the government is doing to crack down on foreign bank accounts. So this FBAR requirement, believe it or not, has been around since 1979. It's been around for a long, long time. Nobody paid attention to it though until really after 9/11. And then more recently with the whole problems with UBS, then it became a big deal, okay? And the government is really focusing on this. It is a big deal. If you don't file a form, an FBAR, a foreign bank account report, the penalties can be as high as 50% of the amount in the unreported account for each year you don't file. So, and they are hitting some people with some big penalties, and there are criminal prosecutions around it. So why do we talk about these currency transaction reports? I'm gonna go back one here. It's because what the government is doing is they're monitoring the flow of cash in the economy. If you look at what they did, is they're looking at cash and they're saying, if you've got cash and you put it into or out of a bank, we want to report on that. And so the person says, okay, so I'm not going to put it in a bank. Then what are you going to do with your cash? I'll buy stuff. But if you buy stuff, you got to file the 8300. So you get a report of that when you're buying stuff. And you say, okay, this isn't working for me. I'm taking it out of the country. You take it out of the country, you got to file a CMIR, okay? And even if you somehow got it out of the country by, for example, we talked about before, I give you cash here, you give me cash over there. If you want to put it into a financial institution there, you got to file an FBAR. So what the government is doing is they're tracking the flow of cash in the economy wherever which way it goes. Not because it's illegal to transact in cash, but because where there's smoke, there's fire. They believe where there's cash, there's illegal activity. Now, people really get caught up with these problems, with these reporting requirements. not when they file them, or not really even when they transact in more than $10,000 of cash. Where's the real problem? It's when people try to avoid having these reports filed. Okay? People say, I don't want to have a currency transaction report filed because I don't want the government to know that I had $20,000 of cash last week and I put it in the bank. So I'm going to take it, I'm going to break it down into three deposits of $7,000, $7,000, $6,000. Okay? That's called structuring. What you're doing is you're structuring your transactions to avoid the filing of the currency transaction report. Or if I'm, you know, at JFK and I'm going to a foreign country, I have $15,000 on me and I take seven and I give it to my wife. Guess what? Can't do that because you're structuring, you're breaking down one single transaction to make it two. So you come under the requirement. So the form doesn't get filed. That's a felony. And that's where people get caught up. They get caught by the banks. You know how you get, and it's a tough case to fight because all you do is you get the bank account statements. And you see on there, 8,000, 8,000, 8,000, 9,000, 8,000, 9,000, 9,000, 7,000, 8,000. It's really, the documents make the case. Why else are you have all those transactions of $8,000, $9,000? Now, I have had cases where I said, you really only had $9,000 each time. $8,000, $8,000, $8,000. You know what he did? Is he would wait in his jewelry business, and every time he got to $8,000, he'd go to the bank. And they'd say, that's ridiculous. Why would he do that? And you know what one good defense was? Because his insurance policy only covered $10,000 of cash at any given time. So he never carried more than $10,000. And so that has worked a lot. And that's something now where the government is on to when they prosecute these cases. The first thing they say is, let's see the insurance policy. But people get caught in that because they say, I thought it was illegal to have more than $10,000 into or out of a bank in cash. It's like the speed limit. You know, if I'm not allowed to go over it, so I stayed right under it. Can I do that? Stay right under it? And the answer is no, you can't stay. I have one client one time say, I didn't think it was illegal, but I just know you didn't do it. It's something you don't do. You don't do more than $10,000 in or out. It's like mixing peanut butter and mayonnaise. You just don't do it. And ever since I heard that, I remember it's like peanut butter and mayonnaise. And so she's like, what? And so she was doing it a lot. The bank filed a suspicious activity report, started a whole tax evasion investigation against her boss. So in the end, we protected him from the tax evasion, but he went down for talking to an FBI agent and making a false statement. Okay, so that's what we'll get into that later. So those are the currency transaction reporting requirements. What's the purpose of it? To tell you when you see cash, you have to be careful. You got to be more sensitive because the government is tracking it. Banks are filing reports on it. And if you're breaking down transactions in a way to avoid filing the reports, then you're also committing the crime of structuring. And maybe you're not doing it. Maybe the guy who's coming to you to ask you to do something with your organization has been doing it. And if you know that it's happening, now you're skating very close to the line of conspiracy, or you're getting closer to the money laundering statutes, okay? And so that's why we talk about it, because I know a lot of you folks aren't doing it, but you may know people who are. And if you're doing financial transactions that help them or is facilitating this in any way, then you could be getting too close to the line. So, the real thing is, when we're talking about non-for-profits, you know, not-for-profits have a lot of, they do a lot of good work. And for that reason, they're encouraged by Congress. And the way Congress encourages people to do stuff is they provide certain tax benefits, right? And so maybe you don't have to pay taxes on your activities. And also they encourage people to donate money by giving them charitable donation deductions. And so there are tax benefits to encourage these good works. So there's a whole tax status around nonprofits. And it's usually in the context of this tax status that I see people getting into trouble. So the heart of what I really want to talk about are the criminal tax penalties and how the criminal tax penalties differ from the civil tax penalties and civil penalties in general. Because I would say 80 to 90% of the cases I see involving nonprofits usually have a tax component to them. Because, you know, nonprofits are all about the tax status. And there are times when it's plain money laundering or wire fraud and mail fraud, but usually there's a tax angle to it. So here are some of the most common criminal tax penalties. I bet you didn't know there are so many criminal tax laws in the books, and this is only some of them. But the interesting thing up there is tax evasion. That's what everybody thinks of. What you got to know is tax evasion says that any person who in any manner attempts to evade or defeat any tax. First thing, that's the statute. Any person and any tax. It doesn't have to be your taxes, okay? If I help Judah underpay his taxes, I can be liable for tax evasion. Okay? It's tax evasion of Judah's taxes. So it's any person who in any manner, I don't have to be involved in filling out the tax return. I don't have to be involved in giving him tax advice. We have nothing to do. I'm not doing anything about taxes, but I am helping him commit tax evasion by facilitating his ability to deal in cash, which I know he's not reporting. And if I know that he's not reporting it, and I'm making it easier for him by helping him to deal in cash, I'm committing tax evasion. It's not even conspiracy. I myself am committing the crime of 7201 tax evasion. So it's very, very broad again, just like the money laundering statute. Then there's other things up here like filing a false return. You can file a false return. You can even file a false 990, okay? An information return for a charitable organization, an exempt organization. There's no tax due, but if it's false in a material manner, that's a felony. So it's up to, you know, the 34-year-old prosecutor whether they want to prosecute that or not. You don't want your life in the hands of a 34-year-old prosecutor who's been out of school for 6 years, okay? But that's what happens. They decide whether they want to make a false return case against you. Then, of course, there's aiding or assisting the filing of a false return if you help somebody do it. This 7212, that's very broad. If in any way you impair or impede the lawful function of the IRS, I mean, and I'm, you know, as a lawyer, that's what I'm supposed to do, right? Clients hire me to impede the IRS. But if I do it corruptly, meaning with an intent to gain an unfair advantage, whatever that means, then I'm violating 7212. So pretty much setting up a shell corporation that helps somebody disguise the source of money that they're getting can be helping somebody to impair and impede the lawful function of the IRS. If you know you set it up to help them hide it from the IRS, you have to have that state of mind. And then there's conspiracy down there. Conspiracy is very broad. We'll talk about that at the end of this discussion. And then, of course, my favorite, making a false statement to a federal official. That is a big no-no. By the way, does everybody here know that Martha Stewart did not get prosecuted and go to jail just for securities fraud? She got prosecuted in big part for making a false statement when she went in to talk about what happened. And they said, you lied when you talked to us. That was a false statement to a federal official. That's a felony in and of itself. The bottom line here is if you're in a sensitive situation with the IRS, don't meet with them yourselves. Don't have somebody else do it. Because if you make a false statement, because you know you don't want to sort of admit the sensitive thing that happened, that's a crime in and of itself. So if you've got a sensitive situation, you're sort of in a catch-22. You can either tell them about the sensitive situation. That's called making an admission. Yeah, I did it. I'm sorry. That's an admission. You have a Fifth Amendment right not to do that. Or you tell them a story so that you don't admit it, but now you've made a false statement. Okay, so either way, it's not going to go well. So if there's a sensitive situation, you need somebody else to interface with the IRS for you. Okay, so what's the difference between these criminal laws that I went over and just a civil problem where, you know, you get slapped on the wrist, you have to pay a penalty or something like that? In the criminal area, it all has to do with the state of mind. The bottom line is we're not going to prosecute somebody and put them in jail unless, to some degree or another, in these white collar areas, they knew what they were doing was wrong. That's different. It's called specific intent. You have to sort of know what you were doing was wrong. Now, that doesn't apply to all the crimes. For example, structuring. You don't have to know that you were structuring. All you have to know is that you were trying to avoid having the bank file the currency transaction report. Okay? That's all you have to know. You don't have to know that structuring is itself illegal. But in most areas with these white collar areas, you do have to know something's wrong. So for example, money laundering, you have to know there's dirty money. For the tax area, you have to know you're breaking the law, the tax law. So it's all about the state of mind. It's different from general intent. If you shoot somebody, you don't have to say, I was trying to kill them. You can be still prosecuted for manslaughter if you knew you pulled the trigger on the gun and it ricocheted off the wall and killed somebody. Yeah, you pulled the trigger purposely, and so you're liable. Not the same for taxes. You had to know that what you were doing was causing an underpayment of tax. Another difference, and so if you didn't really know for sure, but you know you were just negligent, then you get civil penalties. And that's in most of these areas. And it can be bad. Some of the civil penalties can be pretty rough. I mean, your not-for-profit could lose its exempt status if you do enough bad things negligently. But if you cross the line into doing things purposefully, then it's a bigger problem. And that's what the question is, purposefully. It's like, well, I really didn't know. Recklessly can be enough. There's a concept of willful blindness I'm going to come to in just a second. But if you're willfully blind, meaning you turn yourself away and say, I don't want to know, that's as bad as knowing. So you have to be careful about willful blindness. So what makes the difference between criminal and civil is a state of mind. Also, the burden of proof. For a civil penalty, the government just has to prove its case, you know, by 51%, a preponderance of the evidence. But for a criminal case, as we all know, they got to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, because we're not going to put you in jail unless we're really sure you did it. So they got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And another difference between just a civil penalty and the criminal penalties is what happens, the consequence. Okay. When we're talking civil, we're usually just talking money. But I want you to know this. For most federal crimes, they're looking for jail. It's the prosecutor's job. That's how they, you know, the statistics, what they're supposed to do. They're not talking about money. It's not like it's a criminal case. Okay. Let's negotiate our way out of it. Let's, how much can we pay? That's not how it works. They're looking to put somebody in jail. And there's no sort of side deal where if I pay $2 million, we can make this go away. Now, when I say that doesn't happen, you know, sometimes paying can have an effect on how it's viewed by the judge or by the prosecutor, but it's not, okay, now let's sit down and talk about the money. If the government's on to you for a criminal case, they want to put something in jail, okay? So those are the main differences. For tax crimes, we call this state of mind willfulness, okay? You need to have willfulness. And there's actually a civil fraud penalty and a criminal fraud penalty for willfulness. And they're very similar. And the only difference between civil fraud and criminal fraud is whether they think they can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. If they have enough evidence to prove that you willfully underpaid your taxes, then you're talking about jail. If they don't have enough evidence and all they can do is prove it beyond a reasonable, by preponderance of the evidence, then you get a big penalty. So for criminal tax cases, they got to prove willfulness. What is willfulness? Willfulness means you knew what you were doing. How many here have heard ignorance of the law is no defense? Okay, right? You heard that? We all watch, you know, Law and Order. Ignorance of the law is no defense. In tax cases, it can be a defense. Okay, in taxes, ignorance of the law can be a defense because taxes are so complicated. Taxes are so complicated. You know, no tax lawyer or tax accountant knows the whole tax code. I mean, if you look at it, the regulations now are about this wide, you know, and it's on that really thin paper. And the Internal Revenue Code itself is about this thick. Nobody knows all of it, okay? And so it's just ridiculously complicated, and everybody's supposed to follow it. How are we, mere mortals, supposed to follow this ridiculously complicated law? And if we get it wrong, we can go to jail? So the answer is no. You don't go to jail just because you got it wrong. You have to know that what you did was wrong. And so that's why they focus on willfulness. Now, this concept of knowing what you did was wrong, it's subjective. It means that you knew in your own head that what you did is wrong. And if you made a mistake and you thought you were right, no matter how crazy that mistake is, then you're not guilty of a tax crime. It could be a completely ridiculous concept. You could say, I thought that it was completely okay to backdate those documents and kick back the donation. And I thought I was allowed to do that because I read this old magazine article I had from 1952, and they said that you can do that or something. You know, if you honestly believe that, you may have to be put to the proof. But if you honestly believe that, you haven't committed a crime. However, if the government can prove that you did know that what you were doing was wrong, then it is a crime. OK, so they have to prove what's inside your mind. It's actually kind of interesting. How does the government prove that you knew what you were doing was wrong? That's something inside your head. How do they prove that? So for example, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. How do you prove what number I'm thinking of? It's almost impossible to do. It's a very hard burden the government has. So you guys got any thoughts? Can you prove what number I'm thinking of?
Eight.
It was close. Right. Seven. But you see, that's one way to prove what I was thinking is I make an admission. I tell you, seven. That's called direct evidence. That's direct evidence of what I was thinking. I told you what it was. But other than me admitting what I was thinking, yes, I knew we were committing tax crimes. That's an admission. That's direct evidence. Other than that, you can't get direct evidence of what's in my head because only I know what's in my head. So you have to rely on circumstantial evidence. Now, we've all heard circumstantial evidence, right? Again, we saw it on Law and Order. And people say, oh, it's just circumstantial evidence. The whole case is based on circumstantial evidence. That's not a bad thing. Most 99% of cases are based on circumstantial evidence, okay? Very rarely do they have a video of somebody, you know, stabbing. Direct evidence is eyewitness testimony. I saw somebody get shot. I saw somebody get stabbed or something. Or I saw somebody committing tax evasion, okay? That rarely happens. It's all circumstantial evidence. What is circumstantial evidence? I like to call it tracks in the snow. So take this for a moment. Take this example for a moment. You get up one morning and it's been snowing out. You go to the window and you look and there's a beautiful white lawn of snow out there. And it's very pretty. It's a blanket of snow. And you say, wow, that's nice. And you go fix yourself a cup of coffee. You get a cup of coffee and you come back and you look out the window. And there are tracks through your beautiful white blanket of snow. Now, you see those tracks in your white blanket. What can you infer from that? You can infer that somebody walked across. That's an inference. That's circumstantial evidence. You infer from the tracks that somebody must have walked. But you didn't see them walk, okay? If you saw them walk across your yard, that would be direct evidence from your immediate direct senses. You didn't see that. You saw something else that allowed you to infer the ultimate fact, which is somebody walked across. That's circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is evidence of circumstances that allow you to infer something else must have happened. Like this room has no windows. And if I walked in and I was soaking wet and I had an umbrella and I shook it off and water falls off and I put it down, you can't see outside that it's raining, but you have circumstantial evidence that it's raining because I'm all wet and I just came in from outside, okay? That's how they prove what was in your mind. They look at circumstances and from there they ask a jury or a judge or a prosecutor to infer that the person must have known that what they did was wrong. And the government's good at this. They have manuals and manuals on what to look for, okay? And so here are some common badges of fraud in tax cases, okay? This is out of the Internal Revenue Manual. First of all, one of the main things they look for is a pattern. If something happened wrong time and time and time again, that's a pattern of bad things happening. They're just saying in the tax law, once is a mistake, twice is a coincidence, three times is fraud, okay? If there's a pattern and you've done something over and over, it's looking less like a mistake and more like you knew what was happening was wrong. Any attempt to confuse or conceal, or I like to call overly advocate, making some false invoices, telling a false story to the agent. If they find out that it's false, why are you giving me a false story? Why do you have fake invoices if you don't know what's happening is wrong, okay? But other things, you know, double set of books, or I don't have any records. We destroyed them all. It's our policy to destroy them all every 6 months. That sort of thing. I have clients a lot of times say, I don't have any records. I say, well, that's unnecessarily good. You know, the government's not going to be happy with you not having any records. In fact, that's going to be one of the badges of fraud they argue against you, is you destroyed your records or you threw them out so that we couldn't prove our case. Having overly complex structures, coming up with ridiculous stories, creating shell corporations that you don't really need, off the books accounts, using fake names, okay? Using code names, Mr. Green, Mr. Yellow, that sort of thing. Why would you be doing that if you didn't think something was a little bit wrong? So these are circumstantial evidence that they prove to ask somebody to infer that you must have known that what you were doing was wrong. And so also the admissions down there, a double set of books is an admission because one book is correct and one book's false. And I got to tell you, most people keep a set of books, whether it's just written on a little yellow pad, the number of donations you got or how much you kicked back, that's always somewhere. Okay, people like to keep track of it. They want to know. So they always say, no, there's nothing like that until you find out that there's a little piece of paper in their kitchen at home that has that on it. And then there's always the emails. Watch out for the emails. The emails will kill you, okay? So I told you I'd talk about willful blindness. That's another concept you've got to remember because it's very important. It came up in drug cases where there was a guy on the other side of the border of Mexico. He's coming back from vacation. Somebody walks up to him and says, hey, I'll give you $5,000 now and $5,000 on the other side if you carry the suitcase through customs for me. He said, $10,000, sure. And they gave him $5,000 and he carries it through customs. He ignores the fact that white powder is coming out of it and, you know, it's got masking tape around it. He gets caught and said, I didn't know there was anything in there. And they said, really? A stranger comes up to you in the airport, gives you $5,000 and asks you to carry something through and you don't even look in? That's called making yourself willfully blind to what's happening. If you're aware of the high probability that something is happening and you don't look, it's the same thing as if you knew. And so that comes up in these areas a lot. When I meet people and they've got problems, when they've been doing unusual transactions with the not-for-profit, they'll say, I didn't really know. But if it's an unusual circumstance, you're dealing only in cash, you're not keeping records, somebody's using a fake name or calling themselves Mr. Green or Mr. Yellow, You know, those are the types of things that you'd say, even if you can't say they knew that we were doing was wrong, you know they were willfully blind, okay? And so here's how courts apply willfully blindness. They say if you're aware of the high probability of the existence of the fact in question. And United States versus Stadtmauer is a case that actually involved some not-for-profits. In that case, one of the things the government charged them, get this, making donations to charities and then charging them off as advertising expenses, because what they would do is they would make very large donations and then have like big dinners and they'd be in the journal. They didn't take charitable donation deductions though. They took advertising expenses. Why? Because they didn't want to be subject to the 50% per year charitable donation limitation. And they ran it through the Rice Corporation and they didn't have to worry about the limitation. They gave so much away. They were very charitable, but they didn't characterize it correctly. That was just one of the things in this case that was involved. But in Stadtmauer also, there were big tax returns at the construction business. They said that he was expensing things that should have been capitalized. And he said, I never read the tax returns. And they said, yeah, but you had knowledge of enough other things that were happening. And the fact that you didn't read the tax returns, you were just willfully blind to that. And they upheld the prosecution. Okay. So you can see how far willfulness goes. And then finally, there's a broad scope of conspiracy. I don't know if you know how broad the concept of conspiracy can be. But just if we're in this meeting, one factor that government has used in cases to prove a conspiracy is we handed out a PowerPoint at the end of the meeting. I said, can I have all the PowerPoint copies back? I don't want them sitting around so that if the IRS comes, they get them. I'm gonna keep them. Evidence of a conspiracy, okay? Just being on an email chain where they're talking about something that turned out to be illegal, just being on the chain, not talking in, being on the chain, evidence that you were part of the conspiracy. Being on a conference call, evidence of a conspiracy. Making arguments to the IRS about what happened in the transaction, the purpose of the transaction, or some other fact that the IRS later proves was false, evidence that you're part of a bigger conspiracy. So it's kind of crazy how broad conspiracy is. Just all of us being in a room together is almost evidence of a conspiracy. if it later turns out something bad happened, and in retrospect, we were all in the room together, and there's some element of something happened here, that could be a problem, okay? So before we get to questions, I want to just go back to the beginning and talk about some of these things. There we go. Some of these things that we're focused on. So some of this is real cases I've had, okay? And the first ones where people say, I want to make a donation and get a percent back in cash. I've had that. Now that's not going to be a currency violation report. That's not going to be money laundering. That's just going to be plain old tax evasion. It's going to be tax evasion or conspiracy to commit tax evasion. And who's liable? The people at the nonprofit, okay, who were giving back a percentage of the donation, because they know that the person, even if they didn't give the receipt, if they knew the person was taking a deduction, or if they were willfully blind to the idea that the person was taking the deduction. Certainly, taking a donation of a piece of property and overvaluing the property, giving a receipt for overvalue, that was the church I talked about. They took a donation of the house. Yeah, you know, you got to put the, but you have to put a real fair market value. If you put too high a value, it's a problem. Yeah. So backdating a receipt, okay, that's a false document right there. Just if they can prove the backdating, bam, that's the real evidence of evasion. Some of the ones a little bit further down, acceptive cash bag involving $20,000 as a loan, and I don't need a receipt, but when I need money, I need you to write it back to me. Okay, so this is getting close. This is a lot of things. First of all, there's dealing in cash, right? You know, nothing bad has happened yet. You can take a cash donation, okay? And that's all you've done. And you said, maybe I'll need a loan later. Maybe they'll need a loan later, but you've got to worry about the cash. Why is somebody giving you $20,000 in cash? Here's what you do. You have to know your customer. You have to ask questions about where the money came from. And if you're not satisfied from those questions, you should back off a little bit. Because if you're not satisfied and the government later isn't satisfied, they could say you were involved in taking illegal money. And what did I say? If you knowingly or are willfully blind to transacting in dirty money, then that's money laundering. So now we're getting closer to money laundering. We're also getting closer if you do write a check back. Now you could be a check cashing business, okay? You could be a money transmitting business. It has to be registered with FinCEN and with the New York Department of Financial Institutions. And there's all kinds of crimes for failing to register with that. And then also down there, accepting a double endorsed check as a donation, okay? Not prohibited in of itself. But if somebody seems to be hiding the source of where the money's coming from, then you have to ask a question, why are they doing that? That could be a badge of fraud, and it could be an indication that there's dirty money involved. certainly cashing a check for somebody. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, but if you do it, you could end up becoming a money service business that again has to register. The government is looking for stuff like this because you're helping cash move in the economy. And so that's why they want you to register and they want information about it. A couple of other things that I've seen and a little bit more esoteric, nonprofits have a tax exempt status. Sometimes nonprofits will get involved in business deals with people so that their tax exempt status can be used in a way that, you know, you do a partnership and actually a lot of the income is allocated to the nonprofit and then the no tax is paid. And then certain things can happen where value or money kicks back to the other person. And it's just a regular transaction. But the nonprofit is being put in the middle, so the nonprofit status is being used. I've actually seen this and had to argue this with the Attorney General's office here in New York, where people were doing it openly and notoriously. They knew that you would just connect with the not-for-profit and that would generate certain housing credits because you're doing low-income housing credits. You're working with the not-for-profit who's providing low-income housing services. And the way they structured it, they were able to reduce a lot of taxes that they paid. And they thought that that was all okay. And in fact, the Department of Housing liked it that way. If it was fulfilling their purpose of getting these low-income housing buildings built. But the Attorney General didn't like it because they said, hey, you're not paying the right amount of tax. And the Charities Bureau didn't like it. They said, hey, because you're misusing the charity. And so we were able to stop that. But they also said, you stop doing what you're doing. But I've seen people be more aggressive about using nonprofits and business transactions in order to eliminate tax liability. So there's all kinds of things that, that go on out there. But I want to take a break for it. Do you have any questions, Judah?
So I jotted down a couple of questions. So you just mentioned before about the know your customer, right? Mm-hmm. About, you know, in the banking field, you know, they talk about KYC, right? Know your customer.
Yeah.
So if someone is a director of a nonprofit, and what is the expectation in terms of how much they need to know to feel comfortable accepting either cash or accepting really any kind of payment?
Right. Okay. So I thought you were just going to stop. How much do they need to know? How much do you need to know about your customer? And that's sort of a sliding scale because it depends on how suspicious is the transaction. If the transaction is a little bit more suspicious, you need to know a little bit more. I think what you're looking for is if you're engaging in a cash transaction, you know, you have to ask about where the cash came from. Why do you have this amount of cash? And a good question that most financial institutions would ask, and if a financial institution would ask, it's not a bad thing for a nonprofit to ask, is what's the source of the cash? Did you pay tax on it? Did you report tax on it? And why are you engaging in that kind of business activity? If that all makes sense, then you know you're getting pretty close to understanding exactly what happened. But if it doesn't sound like it's making sense and the person is, you know, fibbing a little or coloring a little, or just doesn't make sense that that person would have $50,000 of cash because they say, you know, I sold a car or something like that. That's, you know, that's a lot of cash for a sale of a car. Why did you get paid in cash? So you need to follow up and do a little due diligence, but at some point you're okay, but you have to watch out for this willful blindness concept. You know, am I getting information and just making myself willfully blind to what the truth is?
So a follow-up question, is there a need then for the director to document in some way what kind of due diligence they've done and why they felt comfortable accepting either the donation or the payment?
Sure. Well, listen, I definitely would do a little memo to the file. And depending, again, on how suspicious is the situation, how much cash is involved, then, you know, if it's just $5,000 of cash, that's one thing. If it's $50,000, that's a completely other thing. And if it gets to be a big enough number, I'm just not going to deal with it because it's just the cash, that amount of cash in the economy itself is suspicious. I would do a quick memo to the file to document it. I did have a situation recently where a foreign purchaser wanted to buy a very valuable emerald for many millions of dollars. And it was one of those things where the transaction had to happen now. And it wasn't a cash transaction, but because it was a foreign purchaser and they were going to wire, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the country and it had to happen very quickly, that was suspicious. And so we asked all kinds of questions. And guess what? They faded away. Something was wrong.
I'm just following up on the questions over here. First of all, a lot of what you mentioned was focusing on cash. What about swiping large amounts of credit card, you know, as donations? Is there any concern with your, is there any concern there? It's only cash that we're talking about.
No, I think there's concern in lots of areas, but if it's credit card, now I'm feeling a little bit better because the credit card company is also taking some responsibility for being involved. And, you know, I would take a large credit card donation. You know, that's sort of a bank to bank. If it's a very unusual situation where, you know, I'm going to donate, you know, $500,000, but I've got to complete this tonight. If there's some time pressure about it, I'd sort of wonder what's the time pressure. I'd want to understand that that was. But then if there's no quid pro quo, nothing else unusual about it, and you understand what's happening, I don't have a problem with credit card transactions.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead. What you mentioned earlier about the donation of the rare coins, acknowledging show the value. I always have the impression when somebody donates an item, not cash, you don't give them a receipt with an amount on it. You merely describe what it is that you got, and it's their obligation to get. As long as it's over 5,000, they have to get.
Yeah, no, they should, for tax purposes. That is a good practice. Yeah. Would you think everybody heard that? That would be a good practice. So if you get a piece of property as a donor, I wouldn't give them any acknowledgement. But some people want it because, yeah, they you know, they want it because they also then, for example, in the case I had, they also then went out and got a separate appraisal. But, you know, one person says it's worth this much, then they can use that to get somebody else to agree that it's worth this much. I can get an appraiser to tell me almost anything.
But that's your.
But that's the no. Yeah, if you're just, yeah, if you don't know that they're doing that as a charity, you're fine. And yeah, don't give them any valuation. That's okay. Unless they say, hey, I've got a valuation here, says it's worth 50 and you know it's worth $5. You know.
You can quote that valuation, say per appraisal.
You can't just blindly quote the valuation and say per appraisal $50,000. I wouldn't blindly quote it. If you have reason to know that is wrong, then you got to step back. Like I said, in my case, there were appraisers that said the value of this property was the amount donated on return. People still got prosecuted.
Don't they have to submit that appraisal to the IRS?
You submit it to the IRS. If you have reason to believe that it's wrong because the comps are ridiculous, then that just submitting it, just having an appraisal and submitting appraisal does not protect you if it's not well-reasoned and if the comps are ridiculous, which is what the government argued in this case. We argued endlessly that they weren't ridiculous, but it didn't work.
Here's a couple of other questions, two that are, I think, similar that we've received. So tuition payments in cash. You had mentioned about the fact that a school, unless it's they're engaged in business activity, that would not be considered to be a trade or a business to require the Form 8300. But what about payments of tuition? Would that be considered to be a payment of a business in a business? So if someone were to pay tuition of $10,000 in cash,
right? So the very specific question is whether a Form 8300 has to be filed if I'm receiving a payment of tuition in cash.
Correct.
Is the conduct of my educational activity a separate trade or business? I'd have to research that to give you a binding answer. My sense is it's probably if it falls within your charitable purpose, then it's not a separate trade or business. But that can involve a very sort of fact intensive analysis to make sure that you're on the right side of the Form 8300. I will tell you, though, that there are cases we've seen in our office where people make tuition payments and then say, I'd like to receive that it's a charitable donation, so that they're deducting the tuition payments. And that's a big problem. Okay, so that doesn't work. The very specific question is, do I have to file a Form 8300? I'd have to research that.
Okay, and a corollary then, so a third-party check. So a parent comes in, wants to pay the check, but it's not their name on the check. It's someone else's name on the check. They're coming in to pay tuition.
Right.
Should the school have an issue with that, or should they accept it and credit towards?
I think you can accept it as long as you ask why there's a third-party check. And again, a little memo to the file, inquired of Mr. X, why was a third-party check? They told me that I got this check from so-and-so because of this. You know, you do a little bit of due diligence. And then if the audit comes, or worse, the criminal investigation, you show that you tried to do the right thing, okay? So I don't think you have to reject the money if there's nothing else suspicious about it.
Even if there's no receipt,
You should ask the question. You should ask why not ask the question, and then you're showing that you're being a reasonable person. And that's what the government wants to see you do, is ask some questions.
And a receipt to the third party, are you allowed to do that?
I don't think you give a receipt to the third party, but you should ask why. But if you're doing that, you should ask why.
Of the person who's giving it tuition, they can't
have it. I'll tell you.
No, if it's for tuition, no. But if it's for donation. Yeah. But you should be asking, why are we doing it this way as opposed to a more direct transaction? And that also, the explanation has to make sense. Okay, if it's a ridiculous explanation, then it's not going to work when the agent comes.
I just had a case yesterday where somebody didn't have the money to pay the tuition. Somebody else was paying it on their behalf. And The question is, would you have given them a scholarship otherwise? And if you would have, are you allowed to give a receipt as a donation to the person who pays their tuition if the person was really unable to pay it?
You see, that's a situation where you say, see, but that's becoming a little convoluted. When you say, like, go back, unwind the transaction, why don't you have the guy make a donation? And, you know, if according in accordance with our pre-existing standards, we'd give, you know, the scholarship, then that's okay. But I would unwind the transaction. It's too much together there. It raises questions.
So we have another question here about an organization that receives, you know, small donations, let's say, you know, charity boxes, mm-hmm. yeah. right?
And so going, now they have a lot of cash.
Now they have a lot of cash, and they're going to deposit those large sums of cash. You know, is there anything specific they should be doing in terms of having a conversation about where it's coming from, or just, you know, simply go sure. in?
Sure. Okay. So one thing that this organization should not do is keep all their deposits under $10,000. Okay. That would be structuring potentially. There could be a lot of arguments to defeat a structuring charge, but that could be structuring. I would go to the bank and I would deposit and let them file the currency transaction report. There's nothing inherently bad with that. I've had them filed for me from time to time. And so what you can do is you can speak to the bank, because there are certain customers that the bank knows are going to engage in a pattern of cash deposits or withdrawals of more than $10,000. Then they can file one annual form that covers all of your transactions during the year. And so it's sort of, you know, for example, McDonald's takes a lot of cash in. Every day they're depositing more than $10,000, the local McDonald's depositing more than $10,000 of cash. They don't file CTR every day. They're known to the bank to be engaged in a certain business that generates a lot of cash transactions. They file one blanket umbrella form. So you can maybe have a conversation with the bank about that if it was that much. But otherwise, if it's occasionally $12,000, $7,000, $15,000, just deposit the money, but don't structure it and break it down to under 10.
What would be your...
I assume that a memo to the file would help with that.
So, you know, the contemporaneous evidence of what was happening is always very compelling. Because if you give the explanation 2 years later when the investigator's there, it sounds like you're just making an argument, okay? You know, the fancy lawyer told you to say this, right? But you've got the memo to the file that explains what it is. That's much more solid.
What would be your recommendation in terms of a record retention or destruction policy?
Well, so there's no firm law. Everybody thinks that in the Internal Revenue Code says you only have to keep records for 6 years. That's not true, okay? Or 3 years, whatever, you make up any number. The Internal Revenue Code says you have to keep records as long as you need them to prove your case. So I bought a house 20 years ago and I have to prove how much I paid for the house, so that when I sell it, I can calculate my gain. I need the records from 20 years ago, okay? So there's nothing in the Internal Revenue Code about how long you keep records. So it depends on the individual business about what is an appropriate amount of time. Typically anywhere from 5, 6, 7 years would be a good amount of time, depending on what your volume of records were. But the key to this is the policy, is having a written policy, again, the memo to the file, but having a written policy that says we have a record retention policy that is this, and that you then actually follow it the way it's written. And if you do that, then you're fine. You just say, hey, I've got a record retention policy. This is what we came up with. This is why we thought it was appropriate. And those records were destroyed pursuant to our pre-existing policy. You're going to be in decent shape.
I think that's a 990 question. What record retention?
Do you have a record retention policy? Is that one of the questions on the 990?
No. Shai, any other questions?
So interesting one over here is that a payment sent, if someone sent a payment sent from a directed fund which specifies the payment may not be used for an existing obligation, and this donation is made by a person who is not the parent but is requested to be applied to a tuition, can the not-for-profit accept the payment and apply for tuition? So I guess the question is, can it be considered a receipt? Can you then send a receipt if they wanted to go specific?
Well, the question is it's for tuition, but if it's then also being you can't be fully deducted. You've got to make a distinction between what portion is a charitable donation, what portion is for tuition.
You don't right. need it. It's coming from a fund. The person received the donation already would have put the money in the fund.
Right.
That's the question.
Mm. Then I don't see a big problem.
No,
that, I didn't know that it was that kind.
You can use the fund's money for this, I think is the question. Because the funds will specifically tell you cannot use this money for tuition. Certainly for your own tuition.
I thought he was giving it as a donation. That's what they wanted.
He was giving it for somebody else's tuition.
No. So you can't give it for somebody else's tuition. That's similar to your case. Can I have one person make a donation and have it apply to the tuition for this person because it's like a scholarship? That I wouldn't do. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would unwind it, have the donation, and then separately give it the scholarship. But then it has to be pursuant to your pre-existing scholarship guidelines, which need to be well established, like the record retention policy. Otherwise, it does look like you're paying somebody's tuition and getting a deduction for it. The key is, if they can argue that you're getting a deduction for, you know, services coming back, that's not allowed. And, you know, the government would be interested in that. They'd be interested in that.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for joining. Thank you, Brian, for presenting.
Sure. I hope we didn't talk too much.